I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast, where for the first time in the 27 years since we started this podcast, I am now making John listen to the intro song every single episode.
And it is still tripping me out to actually hear it. And as we talked about on a recent episode, it's why I've shortened or really just gotten rid of the intros altogether, because it's like, oh, we actually say that in the song, so we don't need to say it again. But hello, everybody. My name is John, and today we're joined by Richard Baker. Richard is a former United States Navy officer and game designer. He's the author of 13 novels, and his brand new one, Valiant Dust, is out now through Tor. Richard, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for calling me up.
Oh, you know, you hit the sweet spot of so many things that our listeners enjoy. You got game designer in there. You have a former military officer. There's a big branch, or that's a pun not intended. there's a big faction of people in the nerd community and genre who are either former military people or currently in the military, and they really like that. That part of it. And I'm assuming a lot of your interest, and obviously your current novel is described as a military science fiction. And I certainly want to get into that. But do you have a special connection with fans who are either in the military or former military people?
I would say I do. I talk to a lot of people who say that, for example, they discovered gaming or D&D when they were actually serving. And a lot of times, this is, you know, kind of more back when I was game design was a bigger part of my portfolio. People would ask me all the time, well, hey, did you game a lot when you're in the Navy? And I had to tell them, honestly, no, I didn't. I gamed before I was in the Navy, played a lot in high school and college. And then after I got out of the Navy, I picked it right back up again and started gaming quite a lot. But, during the, my active duty, I actually had very little time to game. I certainly knew of many guys, on my ship, for example, who made a real effort to get out, get together and game pretty routinely. And certainly anytime that I hear that, somebody's been on deployment or, out of the country and has been reading my books, I think it's fantastic. I'm glad that those guys can kind of take their minds off of things for a little bit and relax with something I wrote. I think it's super flattering.
Cool. And we have a friend, his name is Fred Kish, who used to do some work for SF Signal, which we were involved with SF Signal for a while. And I know he goes to, Patrick, you could probably know better than I would, but I think there's a specific con that Fred goes to that is kind of a military.
He goes to HonorCon.
HonorCon, yes.
It's not necessarily military. It's Honor Harrington.
Oh, okay.
So, those are military SF books.
Yeah.
And he just loves that world. And I believe he organized the first of those cons, I believe, is why he was part of he's part of that whole, that's a whole big community, huge community.
Oh, yeah.
And they are very structured, and he helped structure, I believe, the first of those cons or the first few of those cons.
Well, that's pretty cool. So, Rich, are you a fan of the Honor Harrington books?
In fact, I am. And it was funny. A friend of mine by the name of Ed Stark, a guy who now works at with Elder Scrolls Online, and we worked together at Wizards of the Coast for many years. He kept on trying to push these books on me. He's like, "Rich, you got to read this. This is right up your alley." You got to read this. It's right up your alley. And I kept on saying, "I don't know. I'll get to it when I get to it." And finally, he kind of, pushed me into it. And I read through, I read through like 8 books, because that's about how many had come out the whole time that Ed was like telling me, you got to read this. And I finally just like tore through them like in about, you know, a year and a half, right? Just, you know, caught all the way up in the series. And now these days I have to admit, I go right out, you know, first day of the next David Weber book releases. And it's one of the few things that makes me go to the bookstore on that day. And it's like, no, I have to get this, you know, as soon as it comes out. And I make a point of not spoiling it either by looking for like the excerpts or chapters, or because a lot of times David Weber's website will be showing off different things he's working on. And I deliberately don't read that because I want the pleasure of just having the book kind of fresh.
Sure.
You know, when I run out there and get it. So yeah, I am a big fan.
And I believe Fred always says you have to start with On Basilisk Station.
Yeah, I would agree. That's certainly the best place to start. Although it's interesting because in a lot of ways, it's many of the books have followed kind of went a slightly different direction. It's the book that kind of stands out a little bit as being a bit idiosyncratic, I think, in the series. But it's still quite good, and it obviously establishes the character. So it is the place to start.
Cool. Rich sounds like someone who is too humble to state this, but I have a copy of his book. Tor sent me a copy of Valiant Dust, and right on the front cover, quote by David Weber, new and extraordinary, go read this. So if you're a fan of David Weber, his quote, his blurb is right on the cover. And also on the back of the book, it says, Honor Harrington meets the Expanse in an intense new military SF series. So if you like this kind of thing, I think you should go pick this up. He's also got quotes from Michael Stackpole, David Drake, Ed Greenwood, and Eric Flint. So sounds like if you dig this stuff, this is a book that you have to go read. So Fred, if you're listening, if you haven't bought Rich's book, go buy it. What are you waiting for, Fred and everyone else out there? Anyway, I'd love to get back to, I love talking all that stuff. Before we move on into our next section, though, I want to thank the people who back our podcast, those people who are our patrons over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. They contribute every month to the show so that we can keep it running and get cool guests like Rich on the show and just improve it every week. So thank you for the people that are already backing us. If you aren't one of our backers, consider becoming one. If you like these kinds of interviews with Rich, if you get value out of the show, find out about new books like Richard's book Valiant Dust, consider, you know, backing us $1 a month. It really helps a lot. So thank you so much for the people already backing us. And once again, it's patreon.com/functionalnerds. And now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Rich, why don't you go first?
Okay. You know, I was really fretting about this. I have to say that all week long, I was like, I got to try and pick a really cool pick of the week, but I got to pick something.
We've never heard that before.
But not everyone else.
We've never heard that before, ever.
So I'm going to actually go real old school and pick something kind of old. And it's a little bit thematic towards my book. I am making my pick of the week, The Sand Pebbles. The 1964 Steve McQueen movie about an American gunboat on the Yangtze River in China in the 1920s.
Wow, cool.
It is one of my favorite movies. First of all, it's Steve McQueen, right? I mean,
he's Steve McQueen.
Exactly, right? He's pretty awesome.
Yeah. But
it's a really fascinating story of two worlds colliding. The Americans trying to figure out how to do the right thing in revolutionary China, and a great love story. It's amazing scenery. The movie itself is, I think it's just a wonderful glimpse of a world that is very different. And as a naval officer, back in the day, I was always looking around for good Navy movies, and there aren't as many as you would. As you would like. So I always like Sand Pebbles for that reason. And it's I think it's very much worth seeing if you are at all interested in good military movies.
Do you consider The Hunt for Red October to be a good naval movie?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're, that's fine too. Let's be clear.
I'm just curious. I love that movie, and it's one of the few where I love the book.
Yeah.
And the movie is different, but I love the movie.
Yeah. And, you know, they really, you know, in the case of Red for October, they, they did it right. I mean, they really, So, yes, I do like that one too.
Okay, good.
In fact, I almost mentioned that one, except, you know, submarines and the Equus submarines. I was on surface.
Yeah.
Now with Sam Peples, now is that a movie that you have in your collection on DVD? Is that on a streaming service that people can check out?
You know, it is. I do not have a DVD of it, but then you mentioned it. I probably ought to after I just talked it up as much as I did. It's one of those things that when I see that it is on, when I'm channel surfing, I stop and just watch. You know, it's that good.
What channel would that normally like, or what are some of the channels that may be on?
I'm pretty sure I've seen it like on AMC.
Yeah, I was gonna say, AMC or Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
Because with, you know, we talk a lot about the streaming services on the show, and with classic movies, sometimes there's a big library of them in some places.
Sure, right.
There's the big streaming services that everybody knows about, your Netflix and your Hulu and all that. But then there are real niche ones too. And I think there are a lot of kind of classic movies where you do a subscription and then you have access to all of these. So I was wondering if you had a specific place, maybe
you can rent it or buy it on Amazon Prime, John.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's usually
you Googled that fast, did you?
I did. Yeah.
Awesome.
That's usually the way you can do it. Amazon is pretty good, or any of the places where you can buy stuff is usually pretty good in terms of finding that stuff.
$15 Amazon Prime.
And well worth it. Can you rent it too, or do you?
Yeah, no, you can rent it for like $3, or you can buy it for $15 HD.
$3 well spent.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
I always end up buying movies if I do anything, because if you. If you have children, if you have young children, it's very hard to sit and watch 2 hours of a movie in one shot. And to me, the rental window isn't long enough. If they give you a week to get through it, then I would rent more movies. But it's usually once you start it, you have to finish it within
48 hours.
And it's not enough time for me. I need like 3 nights to get through a 2-hour movie. So anyway, but that's a great pick. I'm sure our listeners did. Thank you, Rich. You know what I'm going to pick? I had something else, but I'm going to call an audible here to kind of go along with what Rich picked. I don't think I picked this. And if I did, I'm sorry if I'm picking the same thing a couple weeks in a row. There is a service called Movies Anywhere. Patrick, did I mention this yet? I don't believe so. Okay, so Movies Anywhere is a service talking about purchasing movies. So we have a bunch of stuff that we bought on Amazon. So a lot of kids' movies, all the Pixar stuff and all that we bought on Amazon. I also have purchased quite a few movies on Google Play because I started using that because they take PayPal and Amazon doesn't. So in terms of our video library, in terms of digital stuff, it's all over the place. And many years ago, or a few years ago, Disney started this thing called Disney Movies Anywhere, where if you like bought the DVD, then you'd scan the code and you would get the digital version. Anyway, Movies Anywhere is the newest version of that, where it's basically anything that you have. Well, I shouldn't say anything. It started with Disney movies, but now most of the major studios, or many of the major studios, are participating. It's amazing that this is happening, Patrick, because it's a rare sign of all these companies working together. But if you sign up to Movies Anywhere, and it's free to sign up, and you link your libraries. So right now I have, and I think there's only four things you can link: Amazon, Google Play, iTunes, Apple, and Vudu, which is not something I've ever used, but I think some people have heard of it. Once you link all of those, they will then all appear on the Movies Anywhere channel. Now get this, Patrick, anything that you bought on Google will then appear on Amazon. Anything that you bought on Amazon will appear in Google.
Wow.
And so basically anything that you bought from any of these will appear now in all of them.
Wow. That's pretty
cool. So you will have access. It's really cool, especially when you're not sure what you had. So for free now, all of your whole library, you have access to it. And that's really convenient because depending on your device and all that kind of stuff, you know, you may not have access to all these different things. So it's really helpful. And what's very cool right now is if you sign up, which again is for free, you get 5 movies with it. And it's these five specific movies. It's like the Lego movie. It's mostly kid stuff, but it's, I think it's one of the recent Jason Bourne movies. And so you get five movies for free just by signing up, but it's really convenient and really worth it. It's called Movies Anywhere. And I really recommend it. You have nothing to lose and it makes everything a lot more convenient. So if you owned, if you bought Sand Pebbles, that's the name of the movie you recommended,
The Sand
Rich?
Pebbles,
If you bought the Sand Pebbles on Amazon, then you can now watch it on the Google Play app. You can watch it on the Amazon app. You can watch it on iTunes. You can watch it on the Movies Anywhere app. So now it's available. It would be available everywhere. So well worth it, I think. So that's my pick, Movies Anywhere. Patrick, what's your pick?
Is the Jason Bourne movie, is it the crappy one with Hawkeye?
No, it's the one where Matt Damon came back.
Oh, okay.
It's like, I hadn't kept up with the Bourne movies, so... But I know it's like the one that he came back for. Yeah, not the one with Hawkeye.
Gotcha. Okay. So my pick was already something old, kind of ish. So I love that all these services, when you watch something, they suddenly start feeding you all these other recommendations. And I've watched a few documentaries recently, specifically music driven, you know, the Tom Petty one, and I watched the Doors one. And so they start feeding me other, you know, music driven kind of documentaries. This one tripped me out. All Things Must Pass, The Rise and Fall of Tower Records.
Oh, very cool. Huh.
Directed by Colin Hanks.
Tom Hanks's son,
who's on the show Life in Pieces. Mm-hmm. And he's hilarious in that show, by the way. Mm-hmm. And it's about Russ Solomon founding Tower Records and how it just grew and grew and grew. And then it grew so big that it imploded and died. And it's a great documentary, and the takeaway that blew me the hell away is the fact that Tower Records still exists in this day in Japan and is thriving in Japan. Mm-hmm. Because when Tower Records was having issues and they had to bring in, you know, management to help them try to get out of the hole that they had dug for themselves, one of the things that the creditors and the banks required them to do was sell off the franchises in Japan. So they sold those off to the people who were running them there. And to this day, they are still profitable. They're still there and selling music, just like Tower Records always had. And that blew me away. I didn't realize that Tower Records was still around anywhere.
Yeah. I bet they were helped out a little bit by the resurgence of the LP.
I would say so. Yeah.
I got to imagine that that was timed well for them.
Cause I remember Tower Records in Fresno when I grew up in Fresno, California, and Tower Records was on Blackstone. It was, you know, it was the place where all the cool kids went, and my friends, at least in the beginning, we were all scared to death to go there, you know, because it was like, oh, all the older kids are there. All the cool kids are there. You know, we don't want to, you know, we're all the nerdy kids. We don't want to be seen. We want to hide. But we started going there, and that was just as vinyl albums were being phased out and CDs were coming in. It was that kind of timetable. So I remember Tower Records quite well and hanging out there and doing stuff there. So this just tripped me out. This was a great documentary, and it just talks about, you know, how they built the business up. Basically, Russ Solomon, it sounds like, was not a good businessman as far as actually knowing how to spend money and where to spend money. He just kept growing the business, and he had someone else handling the money. And he would just decide to do something, and that guy had to come up with the money.
Mm. Now, Rich, were you a vinyl guy? Did you get back into vinyl with the resurgence of it?
You know, I never did get back into it. I still have out in my garage, you know, not a ton of, I mean, maybe 100 albums or kind of, and they've been sitting out there for 20 years now, right? So I can't even imagine what sort of shape they're in. But, you know, back in the day, yeah, I started off by collecting. You know, collecting a mix of albums and cassette tapes. That's how far back I go. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when CDs came along, what did I do? I wound up rebuying, you know, like just about every piece of vinyl I'd ever had on CD. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what I miss is, and you know, obviously, I'm totally on, you know, into the, you know, the iTunes age now, and I buy all my music that way and all that. But I miss album covers.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, you know, album covers were a dynamite piece of advertising and mood setting for what you were about to listen to. And, you know, sometimes I have to admit, I when I'd find that stack of albums out in my garage, I'd take a minute and I wouldn't say, oh, I should listen to this. I would be like, oh, I should go look at these album covers again.
Well, and liner notes, right? Liner notes, because there used to be a lot of information in there, not just lyrics. I mean, they almost used to tell stories in there.
Yep. Yep.
And all that's gone now.
Yeah. And I was always, always have been a big progressive rock fan. Mm-hmm. So talk about great album covers. You know, I mean,
okay, I'm gonna say it now because it'll totally derail the conversation. Otherwise, but we're gonna have Rich back because, as listeners know, I'm a huge progressive rock guy. So that would take over the conversation now. So I'm gonna table that for Rich's next appearance on the show.
We'll have to have a round table for you, John, where it's you, Rich, Kevin J. Anderson.
Yes.
Jeff Patterson.
Yes.
You know, Rob Bedford, and you guys just all talk prog rock.
Yes. Yes. That sounds like a good plan. I
Monty Cook's another one. Yeah. If you know of Monty Cook. He's another big, he and I are really the two resident Yes fans at Wizards of the Coast for many years.
Cool. Well, you know, so that brings up two things that I want to ask. First of all, because you did bring it up, do you listen to music while you write, Rich?
You know, it baffles my wife because I just had this immense, you know, playlist and I just turn it on and I don't sort it at all. I don't arrange it at all. I just play it. And she'll walk in when, you know, I've got, you know, something loud and 70s and you know, just you know, wailing away. And she's like, how are you writing to that? And it's like, I didn't even realize it was on. You know, I sort of make a little wall of sound around me, a little white noise it becomes. And I kind of stop paying attention to what the, you know, what's coming randomly out of the player because my head's in the writing. But even so, even though I'm not paying attention to it, it for whatever reason, it just kind of helps me build that little isolation unit and really zero in. I put it on, it just fills the room with some sound and away I go.
I think, you know, we have spoken to many authors over the years and some are big music proponents. Some, I think, like you said, have it to create that isolation booth for themselves. Some get very particular about curating playlists per characters. Like they make a character playlist and when they write a specific character, they listen to the same 10 songs over and over.
Lila Dawson does that.
Yes. Yeah. So there's lots of ways to do it. Some people need absolute silence and can't do anything with any music on at all. So it's different, but I'm always kind of curious being a music person. I'm always kind of curious with authors with that. I know like Stephen King's got to listen to, you know,
classic rock, metal,
classic rock and metal and stuff like that. So everyone's different with it. But the other thing you mentioned is your time at for TSR. Now, was it TSR when you started there? Or was it Wizard? I'd love to know about your time working in gaming.
Sure. Well, I started with TSR in Wisconsin in 1991, and was with TSR for about 6 years. When Wizards came along and bought out TSR very generously, you know, took, you know, the 2/3 of the company that was associated with the creative side of things and moved us out to Seattle to, you know, to keep on working on D&D. And so in 97, I relocated from Wisconsin to Washington State, and I've been here ever since. I wound up working at Wizards of the Coast all the way up until December of 2011. And so I wound up working on Dungeons & Dragons in its second, third, fourth, and fifth editions with 20 years in between TSR and WotC.
So I mentioned Tower Records. I grew up in Fresno. My mom worked at a restaurant, Italian restaurant called Luigi's. She was first a waitress and then a bartender. And behind that was Tower Records. It was like a strip mall. Tower Records and a hobby shop. And in that hobby shop, I bought the red box.
Sure.
And I've got it here. And on page 23, I have a question on page 23 of the manual. No, I'm not. But that is where I bought that. I bought the red box, and then I think it was the blue.
Sure, yeah.
And then we had red, blue, silver, black, and gold.
Mm. Now, Rich, I would love if you told us a little bit. I a couple months ago, one of my picks was the biography on Gary Gygax. So did you actually work with Gary Gygax at all? Did you have any interaction with
him? No, he was he had been out of TSR for several years by the time I came on board. So I wound up actually not even meeting the guy until I would say at least like 7 or 8 years after I started there. When I happened to run into him at Gen Con and was introduced by the people I were with who, you know, were people who knew him and so. And I mean, literally, I think the extent of my interaction with Gygax was, hello, Mr. Gygax, it's nice to meet you. Right. That might have been about as far as as much as we ever talked about.
How about Ed Greenwood?
Oh, Ed, I know very well. Obviously, I knew him a little bit in the 90s, even though I didn't do a lot of work with Forgotten Realms in the 90s. But when we did the third edition Forgotten Realms, I wound up taking over as creative director for the Forgotten Realms line and ran it for through the early part of the third edition work. So I got to know Ed very well during that time. He's a fantastic guy, one of my favorite people in the world, and I think we actually wound up turning out some pretty good, you know, pretty good game stuff then.
Agreed.
So. You know, super guy, and you know, it's funny when my editor was asking me, "Hey, can you think of anybody that would, you know, any other authors who would say something nice about your book?" Because that's what they do, right? They kind of ask you, "Hey, we're going to go and ask a few people for, you know, some testimonials, you know, these nice quotes you get." And you know, we have some ideas. Do you know anybody that we should ask? And I was like, "Well, Ed Green was the first guy I told him. I was like, Ed knows me. He's read my stuff, and he will certainly say something nice about me." So.
Well, that's good. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of like what's I'm curious because I am not a gamer. Patrick is.
Sure.
I know a little bit about the world, but what, you know, day to day, what kind of work? I'm sure it changed over the years. You worked for a long time there, but what's a day in the life of a game designer like? What kind of work do you do?
As a game designer, we would be assigned, you know, it's sort of like going to college and when you have, you know, it's sign up day, you're going to sign up for your classes for the quarter. About once a year, we would have the, hey, here's the stack of projects we're going to be working on this for the upcoming year. You know, this is the stuff that's all been kind of approved by management. And these are the projects we're going to proceed forward with. And we'd have the, essentially the sign up day where we'd all go in and say, okay, my number one pick is I want to work on this. My number two pick is I want to work on this. My number three pick is this. And under no circumstances do I want anything to do with that one over there. And, you know, and, you know, with everyone probably asking to all want to work on the same thing that they thought was coolest, you know, there'd always been some compromising and deal making that went on to, you know, get everyone assigned what they're going to work on for the next few months. And then you would have, about 1 month per 20,000 to 25,000 words worth of, length in the thing you were going to be working on. And, you know, usually that would, you know, my cut of something would be anywhere from about 2 months to 4 months worth of work. And, you know, a lot of that would be coming in and turning on the computer and banging out your 2,000, 3,000 words for the day. But then you'd also be mixing that in with, you know, concept meetings, play testing. You know, hey, I came up with an idea for a new kind of character class. I need to see if this is crazy or not. You know, we're going to actually take a couple of hours out of the day and run it through some encounters and see if it works or not. A fair amount of I would say details like managing and communicating with freelancers who might be participating in the project, prepping the art order. So, you know, because the art directors have no idea what what the adventure's about. Okay, you need me. This is adventure about giants, right? Yeah, it's giants. Let's make sure we put giants in the pictures, right? Okay, got it. Yeah, but it's the designer is the person who's going to have a sense of what ought to be, illustrated in a particular adventure. Hey, there's this awesome set piece boss encounter. We got to make sure we do a nice illustration of that, and here's what we're going to need for that. And you would produce that material and give that to the art director, and they would be the ones who would run off and find the artist and work on all that end of things. But they would start by sending your art description off to somebody to begin with.
Do you miss Taiko?
No, I do not.
I don't think anybody does.
Now, during this time while you're doing, where you're working as a game designer, I'm going to go ahead and assume that you were writing your novels as well. You have 13 novels to your credit, unless you've banged them all out in the past couple of years.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
That is correct. I actually started, by writing novels for the properties that TSR/Wizards of the Coast owned. At TSR and WotC, there's actually a pretty strict non-compete agreement that really kind of prevents you from doing any side writing for anybody else. And on the bright side, though, at different times of the company's organization or philosophy, if you will, we were allowed to throw our hats in the ring and say, hey, I've been doing a lot of work on Forgotten Realms. I'd like to write a Forgotten Realms novel. And that would be something that you would actually do kind of on your own time. It'd be assumed that it'd be, your evenings, your weekends. If that's what you want to do, that's great. So I broke into writing, for Forgotten Realms and all those Forgotten Realms novels because that was the only place where I could actually do fiction writing if I wanted to do something, different in my evening rather than just doing game design. So I wound up kind of being sort of in the right place at the right time because obviously the book department folks were kind of right down the hall and I could go talk to them or pester them anytime I wanted to. Being a professional writer and knowing the property as you would as a being a game designer meant that you could at least usually make a pretty cogent pitch to, hey, I've been doing this thing on the game design side, but I want to write about a character doing this sort of thing and actually tell a great, I've got a good idea for a novel. I see you guys are looking for, an opportunity to start a new series in, the novel world. What do you say? So I managed to kind of luck into it a little bit. It wound up being something that I got, a dozen Forgotten Realms books out of because I started off because I was in the right place at the right time. And I guess they liked what I did because they kept letting me do it again.
And John, this might be a topic for another episode, but he mentioned a non-compete clause and a pretty strict one. That's something I think a lot of authors have to deal with their day jobs. Like I have a very specific non-compete clause where I work right now. And luckily it's because it's the sports industry. It doesn't touch anything that I do outside of work.
Sure.
But other people have some pretty strict ones, including like anything you work on while you're employed there belongs to them.
Yeah, certainly that was the flavor that TSR/Wizards of the Coast/Hasbro puts on people, which obviously whether or not they would ever try to enforce it, whether it's actually really enforceable, you talk to some lawyers and some will say, sure, yeah, that's, maybe, maybe not, but who wants to test that?
Right. Which reminds me, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm looking forward to the Battleship/Dungeons and Dragons/Transformers/GI Joe crossover movie next summer.
Now, Rich, did you always have it in your mind to write novels, because you did have your career in the Navy, and I know you were gaming prior to the Navy, and then you worked in gaming. Did you were you writing at a younger age? Did the thought to become a novelist come later in life? How did that work for you?
You know, I would say certainly, you know, even going back as far back as, you know, like middle school, high school, you know, I certainly, I think, had some ambition to write, to tell stories, right, to be creative and make things. And, you know, I even like through high school and college, I was starting to fiddle around with world building and coming up with story arcs for things because it, you know, that's just something that I found interesting and I wanted to do something with. I actually wrote my first book, while I was in the Navy. I cranked out a 200,000 word epic fantasy monster of a manuscript, basically kind of working evenings, weekends. I actually stashed I had a personal computer wedged in my tiny little stateroom on my ship. And when I was off duty, off watch, if I had, a couple of hours more or less to myself, I'd take half an hour, 40 minutes and kind of bang away at the manuscript. So that book was actually kind of terrible. I never sold it, never managed to really do anything with it. But what it did do is it taught me that I could start something on page one and take it all the way to page the end and finish a story that was what I wanted it to, or what I thought I wanted it to be anyway. And it kind of was a bit of proof of concept that I was able to say, okay, well, you know what? I can do this. I shopped it around and I tried to sell it, and I didn't get anywhere with that. But, I do feel like that was a bit of a door opener for me, later on when I did wind up, applying for a job at TSR that I was, they looked at me and was like, okay, you've been in the Navy. What have you ever done in the way of professional writing? It's like, well, I haven't, but look, here's a gigantic manuscript that I knocked out. I know I can put words on paper and keep up a good pace at it. So I like to think that manuscript, even though it didn't actually ever sell, was something that maybe convinced Jim Ward at TSR that, well, he could take a shot at me, take a risk, gamble on me there, and maybe I would pay off.
Now, and that brings us to the current day with Valiant Dust. So, how did this book come together? Did you kind of pitch this to an agent first, and then so how does Valiant Dust come together? Because it is book one of the Breaker of Empires series, so it's, I don't know how many books it's going to be eventually, hopefully 20, but
I hope I get a chance to write this character until I'm sick of him, right?
That's right.
And then do a couple more books after that, right? So in 2011, I parted ways with Wizards of the Coast, and I kind of found myself for the first time in at that point 20 years with the opportunity to, write anything I wanted, right? I didn't have to sit there and say, well, the only thing I can write is going to be a Forgotten Realms novel because that's the only novel line they have running right now, and that's the only thing that they'll buy from me. I was kind of a free agent for the first time in a very long time. And so I kind of sat down and thought about it and said, okay, well, I'm now in the position of being able to write anything I want to write. If I could write anything I wanted to write, what would that be? And I thought about the books that I had been reading and enjoying quite a lot, for a number of years, and military sci-fi has always been a genre I've enjoyed quite a lot. But of course, I couldn't write any of it, while I was working at Wizards. So I said, well, hey, that obstacle's removed. I'm not with them anymore. I've got the opportunity here to sit down and take a whack at this and see what I can do. So, the character Sikander North, the Breaker of Empire series came out of me looking around and saying, all right, what do I want to write? And what do I think I would enjoy reading? So I thought about it, did some world building, did some planning and thinking, and put together a first draft of a book, and went, shopping around for an agent, which once again, because I've had half a foot in the publishing world for quite some time, and at least I could go to them and say, hey, you know, I'm not necessarily a guy coming at the bottom of your slush pile. I've published quite a lot of stuff. That gives you the advantage of at least they'll answer your email, right? Oh yeah, I've heard of you. Okay, sure. What have you got? You know, so I was relatively fortunate. I had a great agent, a guy by the name of Richard Curtis, who's been around the business for a long time. Snapped up Valiant Dust really within just a few weeks of me, you know, starting to shop around for an agent. And he obviously he's a guy who's represented many different sci-fi and fantasy authors across the years, and kind of knows everybody. He wound up taking it to tour, where Jennifer Gunnels, bought it really within about a month or 6 weeks of Mr. Curtis starting to shop it around. So, I actually have a very atypical story as far as how did my book get sold in, because, I think I got a little bit lucky.
Well, isn't luck usually part of the whole process?
There is certainly an element there, and I would say was it entirely luck? Well, no. I mean, I did have a resume of, you know, a lot of Forgotten Realms writing to fall back on, which certainly, like I said, get your foot in the door. At least most people will stop what they're doing and look at what you're sending them if they've seen you publish before. Yeah, because, you know, agents are people too, right? They don't want to miss on something if they look at, oh, okay, this guy, I see this guy's done stuff, right? I want to make sure I at least look at it and see if this is something I can work into my, you know, into my stable here.
Sure.
So yeah, it's in a lot of ways, Valiant Dust is kind of a labor of love, right? It's the thing I said, you know, when I kind of got out from under many years of working on fantasy books and saying, okay, finally, I don't have to write about elves. I can take a break and try something different, you know, with like railguns and lasers and stuff. Okay.
So I'm curious. You mentioned that you read the Honor Harrington books. Are there other kind of military SF books that inspired you? Or that
sure,
you enjoy?
I mean, I would say that, you know, going way back, when I first started reading sci-fi, a kid like sixth, seventh, eighth grade, the little public library in my hometown had a spinner rack of sci-fi novels, and many of those had been there for decades. and so I kind of cut my teeth on what I think of as golden age sci-fi, right? Stuff that wasn't necessarily like super current. But you know, Asimov and Heinlein and Doc Smith and all that stuff was kind of where I really, you know, did all my early reading, even though I was doing this, gosh, in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, right? And these guys, I was reading things that were in some cases 40 years old at that time, right? But so we mentioned obviously Honor Harrington, but the other military sci-fi series that I would say I've always kind of loved, and it's got warts. It hasn't necessarily aged well, but man, I'm a gigantic fan of the Lensman books.
Oh, okay.
E.E. Doc Smith's Lensman series. Doc Smith, you don't read him for character development. you don't read him for dialogue. There's some stuff in there that's kind of hard to like. It was written in a day and age when, writers assumed that men were men and women were women and they shouldn't try to do each other's jobs. Right. I mean, so there's stuff about Dax Smith, like I said, that does not age well, but the thing he did brilliantly is, man, he had a big idea, a grand vision for, for a struggle between good and evil, in the Lensman series. And, just the sheer audacity of that story, I think is fantastic. And I have to admit that here and there across my career, I've looked for little ways to kind of slip in, you know, a little bit of Doc Smith homage here and there when I can, because, you know, it's in a lot of ways, I think it's kind of super foundational to a lot of things we take for granted now. For example, Star Wars is not, it's not a knockoff of Doc Smith, but it's certainly, you know, there's little hints of, of the linesman and Doc Smith in the original Star Wars.
There's a lot of influences in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And there's websites that talk about, you know, all the different elements that people see in that movie that came from different movies and different books. I recently burned through the Tanya Huff Valor books. Are you familiar with those?
I have not read them.
I really, really enjoyed those. And, you know, it's basically you have the Confederation and the others, I believe. And there's just this war going on, and the young races, humans are part of the young races, kind of got added to the big conglomerate because, you know, the old aliens have gotten above war. They don't know how to fight war anymore, but humans do. So we'll just add you and we'll make you go fight our war for us. So that's kind of the setting. And so that's interesting.
That sounds like fun, actually. I'll look for those.
Yeah, please do. I really enjoyed them. And she takes the character of Gunnery Sergeant Tor through war and into peace. You know, so it's just kind of, it's an interesting character arc for me. The other one I've tried to get into is Jack Campbell.
I have read the Jack Campbell books.
Okay.
At least the first six or so.
I read the first book in the Lost Fleet, and it didn't really do much for me, but I've been told that they just get better as you go.
I can see that. I can see why people would say that. Sure.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Yeah. I would say the Jack Campbell stuff I have read. John Scalzi's Old Man War.
Oh, I love those books. Those books.
Yeah.
Now, do you still game?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, obviously these days I spend most of my time writing, but I have a little game publishing company on the side. Me and a couple of buddies of mine, former colleagues at Wizards of the Coast, got together a few years ago and formed a little outfit called Sasquatch Game Studio.
Nice.
And we just, you know, put out a couple of games a year as, you know, things that, you know, things we find interesting, things we're having fun with. So, in fact, this upcoming week, while I'm working on, I'm working on my next book, I'm also going to be working a little bit here and there on our alternative science fiction role-playing game. We kickstarted it a few months ago, and now we've actually got a manuscript, you know, coming together. So when I get tired of writing about battleships in space and lasers and aliens, I'll go do that. I'll go do that for the sci-fi game instead. I do keep my hand in the game biz a little bit, and certainly I love gaming. Still it's one of my big hobbies. We have a Thursday night D&D game. It's been running for years and years. I love playing in. My buddy Dave got me into War Machine miniatures.
Yep, that's expensive.
Yes, it is. I have spent an inordinate amount of money on my a stack of miniatures, but you know what? I hadn't painted a lot for like 15 years, and I kind of I had to go buy all new paints and kind of start rediscovering how to paint. And man, I've just been having a blast painting them. It's been one of my most fun things these days is actually just sitting down and spending an hour and a half kind of working on this unit or that grid, that great big robot. And you know, it's just something I'm enjoying these days. Darn thing is, I hardly ever get a chance to play the game. I play the game about once every 3 months or so, and I'm terrible at it. But man, my army looks good.
my group just started a Dresden Files game. And by just started, I mean it was like 6 months ago, and we played twice. You know, it sucks. But there's a miniatures game now for Star Wars. And if I lived closer to Anelio, I would totally get him hooked on that. So he would have to start buying those little ships. Yeah.
I could, as you were saying that, as you said about painting the miniatures, I'm like, you know what? I don't have the space.
Well, you don't have to paint. Live right some now. People paint, some people don't.
No, but I can see getting into that. Not that but I could see like putting my progressive rock album on. And sitting down, and I could see that being an enjoyable way to spend an afternoon.
I talked about that hobby shop, and they did sell the little miniatures, right? And so I remember buying those miniatures, and I'm going to paint them, and I'm going to, you know, have all these really cool miniatures. And I really, really sucked at it. And so you had, you know, like I had all these brushes, and I would try to like paint their faces and different, and you would just get like blobs of paint, and it was just, it was a horrible thing. So I am not a painter. I don't paint, but I would totally buy all the miniatures. I totally would, and just have them.
Nice. Well, once again, right now, Richard Baker has a new novel out. It's called Valiant Dust. It's out through Tor. It is out as of November 7th, I believe, was the publication date. It is out in hardcover. I'm assuming it's in ebook. And do we have an audiobook too? Do we know about that?
Yes, there is. So obviously the ebook's out right now. The audiobook came out this week, narrated, read by an actor by the name of Steve West, and the guy's dynamite.
Awesome.
I love the reader for the audiobook.
So important. We talk about that all the time, about how important the, because obviously our audience, a lot of the folks in our audience are like audio. So they like the audio books too.
Of course.
So they, you know, depending on who's reading it and who's doing the voice work, it really makes a big difference. So I'm glad to hear they're happy with that.
The awesome thing about Steve West, the guy actually sent me a list of like, you know, like 50, 60 different questions after he'd read the manuscript, you know, about obviously a fair number of things like, how do you say this? How do you say that? How do you say this other thing? But kind of more like second level questions like, okay, so this group of people from this kind of planet, what sort of broad accent would these guys have? You know, what do you want them to try and sound like? And at the point where I'm like, okay, this guy is seriously engaging with this material, right? He's looking at it, he's thinking about it, he's super invested in trying to get it right. And he's also a professionally trained, London actor, I think. And in England, right, they take that stuff very seriously, right? So this guy's diction, his ability to do accents is fantastic. I can't say enough good things about the job he did with the audiobook. It's great.
Awesome. Cool. Well, that's a big selling point for our listeners, I believe, is knowing that there's a good person. That's great. Well, I'm glad to
hear it. It's all about the narrator.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. All right. So that's out now. Valiant Dust. Anything else you want to let our listeners know about? Are you going to be going to any cons? Anything, any other projects that you might want to let our folks know about?
The big thing, I guess, would be coming up in a few months. I'll be at the Emerald City Comic Con. Which is a comic convention out here in the Seattle area. I'm going to be on a panel or two. We're getting that sorted out right now. I'm almost certainly going to be at Gen Con in the summertime, both because I love the games, and secondly, I'm also going to be doing a little bit more there with, I think, the fiction track.
Which has become almost its own separate convention within a convention.
Yes, it has. It is amazing how many... obviously, being a veteran of many Gen Cons, I'm amazed that I go down there and be like, this is like a whole other con going on within the con. It literally is. It's a great program that they have there.
And it's getting a lot of buzz. People, a lot of authors are talking about how it's just a wonderful, wonderful, almost like a writer's conference at this point.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Very cool. Very cool. Anything else, Rich?
Like I said, that's the big stuff. In a couple of months, it'll probably, sometime in spring, I mentioned that alternative science fiction game. We should have, that should be hitting the stores, I think, probably March, April, possibly May. It depends how fast I get things done. So that'll be our my next most immediate thing that comes out. And then about a year from now, we'll have book two of Breaker of Empires on the way. I've already got the manuscript done. It's in editing right now, and I think Valiant Dust is great, and I think the next one's going to be hopefully even a little bit better.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely have to have you back on when book two comes out. For us this week, once again, if you dig the show, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything you want to let people know about?
I was just thinking about, Rich picked The Sand Pebbles, and I mentioned The Hunt for October. Obviously, the third best naval movie ever made is The Final Countdown.
Okay, it's fun. I guess. I'm trying to think. Trying to think what I do for the third best. That's actually.
Oh, yes, I remember that movie. Oh my gosh! No, that's all I had, John. I just. I'm curious because I living in Colorado, living in Denver, and then we have Colorado Springs. We have a lot of military here, and it's interesting to Rich's point how many of them are gamers and they're into science fiction and, you know, a lot of authors. Kevin Eikenberry is a local author here. The only problem with Ike is that, you know, he worked for a little while at Cheyenne Mountain and he will not confirm the Stargate to me, which really bugs me because, you know, come on, Colorado Springs, Stargate.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Stargate. I got to get my son into that so I can rewatch all of that. I mean, I know I could just rewatch it on my own time, but I, you know, I'd like him to watch it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
All right. Well, Rich, it was a real pleasure having you on the show today, and we look forward to getting you back on the show. I feel like we could have done this for another hour or two and not run out of stuff to talk about. So.
Oh, and John, I promised him no gotcha questions, but I lied.
Uh-oh.
All right, what's...
When you play D&D, what edition are you playing? Gen.
Actually these days, most of our gaming is in, 3.5.
Okay.
There's things I like about just about every edition, to be honest. But a lot of the guys I play with still love to try to really crunch out the best, most broken, crazy character combos that they can. and that means the third edition and some of the source books there, you know, that's definitely the place to go if you're, if you like building crazy character combos. So awesome. It's like, you know, myself, I'm kind of happy to just, you know, just roll some D20s and bash stuff. But, you know,
we
if that's what those guys like, you know, knock yourselves out.
We have, when we play, we go to Pathfinder.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
very similar.
One of my friends of the podcast, he basically got rid of all his D&D books. He got so angry and has just switched to Pathfinder. And when he runs a game, he runs a Pathfinder game. But we also do a lot of now, we've done the, cause we're doing Dresden Files, right? So we're doing Fate Core and we play a lot of different systems now. So it's fun though, because you can change things up.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, John, I'll stop.
All right. Well, we're like coming up on exactly an hour, which I think you were just trying to get it, because I think last time or one of the recent times we stopped at exactly an hour. So, Rich, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. We had a blast. Best of luck with the book. I'm looking forward to reading it. I got it right here. Awesome. So, yeah, very good. And everybody else, have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.
Smoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
'You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.